Chapter 6. There is satisfactory evidence that many professing to be original witnesses of the Christian miracles passed their lives in labors, dangers, and sufferings, voluntarily undergone in attestation of the accounts which they delivered, and solely in consequence of their belief of those accounts, and that they also submitted from the same motives to new rules of conduct. When we consider first the prevalency of the religion at this hour, secondly, the only credible account which can be given of its origin, viz., the activity of the founder and his associates, thirdly, the opposition which that activity must naturally have excited, fourthly, the fate of the founder of the religion, attested by heathen writers as well as our own, fifthly, the testimony of the same writers to the sufferings of Christians, either contemporary with or immediately succeeding the original settlers of the institution, sixthly, predictions of the suffering of his followers ascribed to the founder of the religion, seventhly, letters now in our possession, written by some of the principal agents in the transaction, referring expressly to extreme labors, dangers, and sufferings sustained by themselves and their companions. Lastly, a history purporting to be written by a fellow traveler of one of the new teachers, and by its unsophisticated correspondency with letters of that person still extant, proving itself to be written by someone well acquainted with the subject of the narrative, which history contains accounts of travels, persecutions, and martyrdoms, answering to what the former reasons lead us to expect. When we lay together these considerations, which taken separately are, I think, correctly, such as I have stated them in the preceding chapters, there cannot much doubt remain upon our minds but that a number of persons at that time appeared in the world, publicly advancing an extraordinary story, and for the sake of propagating the belief of that story, voluntarily incurring great personal dangers, traversing seas and kingdoms, exerting great industry, and sustaining great extremities of ill usage and persecution. It is also proved that the same persons, in consequence of their persuasion, or pretended persuasion, of the truth of what they asserted, entered upon a course of life in many respects new and singular. From the clear and acknowledged parts of the case, I think it to be likewise in the highest degree probable that the story for which these persons voluntarily exposed themselves to the fatigues and hardships which they endured was a miraculous story. I mean, that they pretended to miraculous evidence of some kind or other. They had nothing else to stand upon. The designation of the person, that is to say, that Jesus of Nazareth, rather than any other person, was the Messiah, and as such, the subject of their ministry could only be founded upon supernatural tokens attributed to him. Here were no victories, no conquests, no revolutions, no surprising elevation of fortune, no achievements of valor, of strength, or of policy to appeal to, no discoveries in any art or science, no great efforts of genius or learning to produce. A Galilean peasant was announced to the world as a divine lawgiver, a young man of mean condition, of a private and simple life, and who had wrought no deliverance for the Jewish nation, was declared to be their Messiah. This, without ascribing to him at the same time some proofs of his mission, and what other but supernatural proofs could there be, was too absurd a claim to be either imagined or attempted or credited. In whatever degree, or in whatever part, the religion was argumentative when it came to the question, "Is the carpenter's son of Nazareth the person whom we are to receive and obey?" there was nothing but the miracles attributed to him by which his pretensions could be maintained for a moment. Every controversy and every question must presuppose these, for however such controversies, when they did arise, might and naturally would be discussed upon their own grounds of argumentation, without citing the miraculous evidence which had been asserted to attend the founder of the religion, which would have been to enter upon another and a more general question. Yet we are to bear in mind that without previously supposing the existence or the pretense of such evidence, there could have been no place for the discussion of the argument at all. Thus, for example, whether the prophecies, which the Jews interpreted to belong to the Messiah, were or were not applicable to the history of Jesus of Nazareth, was a natural subject of debate in those times, and the debate would proceed without recurring at every turn to his miracles, because it set out with supposing these, inasmuch as without miraculous marks and tokens, real or pretended, or without some such great change effected by his means in the public condition of the country, as might have satisfied the then received interpretation of these prophecies, I do not see how the question could ever have been entertained. Apollos, we read, mightily convinced the Jews, showing by the Scriptures that Jesus was Christ, Acts 18.2. But unless Jesus had exhibited some distinction of his person, some proof of supernatural power, the argument from the old Scriptures could have had no place. It had nothing to attach upon. A young man calling himself the Son of God, gathering a crowd about him, and delivering to them lectures of morality, could not have excited so much as a doubt among the Jews whether he was the object in whom a long series of ancient prophecies terminated, from the completion of which they had formed such magnificent expectations, and expectations of a nature so opposite to what appeared. I mean, no such doubt could exist when they had the whole case before them, when they saw him put to death for his officiousness, and when by his death the evidence concerning him was closed. Again, the effect of the Messiah's coming, supposing Jesus to have been he, upon Jews, upon Gentiles, upon their relation to each other, upon their acceptance with God, upon their duties and their expectations, his nature, authority, office, and agency, were likely to become subjects of much consideration with the early votaries of the religion and to occupy their attention and writings. I should not, however, expect that in these disquisitions, whether preserved in the form of letters, speeches, or set treatises, frequent or very direct mention of his miracles would occur. Still, miraculous evidence lay at the bottom of the argument. In the primary question, miraculous pretensions and miraculous pretensions alone were what they had to rely upon. That the original story was miraculous is very fairly also inferred from the miraculous powers which were laid claim to by the Christians of succeeding ages. If the accounts of these miracles be true, it was a continuation of the same powers. If they be false, it was an imitation, I will not say of what had been wrought, but of what had been reported to have been wrought by those who preceded them. That imitation should follow reality. Fiction should be grafted upon truth, that if miracles were performed at first, miracles should be pretended afterwards. Agrees so well with the ordinary course of human affairs that we can have no great difficulty in believing it. The contrary supposition is very improbable, namely that miracles should be pretended to by the followers of the apostles and first emissaries of the religion, when none were pretended to, either in their own persons or that of their master, by these apostles and emissaries themselves.